Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stas Ziolkowski.
Today is Monday, September 11th, 2023, and our theme today is remembering 9/11. How was your week, Stas?
Well, pretty good being homebound.
You're probably finding lots of interesting things to do while you're bound at home.
I did manage to get two projects done that I've been meaning to do. And the second one is almost completed, but I had to stop because I ran out of time. I'll get it done tomorrow, probably, or not tomorrow, next day. Anyway, I've had a good week. I saw people, occupational therapist, physical therapist, nurse. I saw, I think I'm up to 11 or 12 visits now. I'd have to check the calendar to be sure.
Wow.
And I have a visit today at 1 o'clock with Kate, who was the first person to come and see me after I got out of the hospital. So, and it's incredible, but it's a month ago that I fell. No, excuse me. 3 weeks ago. I don't know, gosh. I get so mixed up on the dates. It actually is a month ago tomorrow that I, 4 weeks ago tomorrow that I fell.
Really?
In the hospital. Yeah, the 15th of August. I think I'm counting that right. Maybe I'm not. So there are 16 days left in August. Counting 15, 14, 17 and 11 is 28 days. Yeah. Tomorrow will be 28. Well, and I've got wonderful care. Thanks.
Making it this far.
I'm not sure what that means.
That means I know you're not done with all the.
Oh well, I seem to be doing well. I'm on my cane now, and I've gotten to where I've been walking. I've walked around the house a number of times without my cane, and my balance is really good. I'm not worried about not being able to walk properly and stuff like that. And each of my last three therapist visits have been, very positive. They're real encouraged that I'm doing really well, and probably very likely this week I'm going to get off home healthcare.
All right.
So, and tomorrow, not tomorrow, Wednesday, I go to see the heart doctor that I met in the hospital, who I'm hoping will be able to tell me good news, because the monitor I was wearing, and we mailed off to the company on the 31st of August, he should have gotten the results by now, and he'll be able to tell me that he doesn't have to do anything special, I hope, because I'm done with, I really am fed up with my body, I feel pretty good and all that stuff, but I am so slow compared, I wish I knew a bunch of, I do know some people my age, but I mean, I wish it was a place I could go and sit with a bunch of guys my age, men and women, and just share some stories and also get an idea, because I feel like old age has crept up on me. I never had things like this, even though I've had broken things and replaced hips and replaced shoulder and surgeries and all that stuff. I never felt like I was really falling apart until, I guess really until sometime in Pittsburgh, before we moved to Sharpsburg, sometime around 2015 or so, I started to really feel my legs didn't work as well as they could used to, and walking was hard, stuff. And but now I'm old, and I accept it, and it's okay, you know.
Well, before you get any older,
yeah,
you want to talk about sneak?
Yes, and that's big time coming up tomorrow, September 12th and 13th. Diane Macklin, oh boy, and she is dynamic, theatrical style, and she is such an outrageously good storyteller. I have seen her a number of times, especially in workshops, but also in performance. And she is the person who was given the award for the challenge of creating a new story to debut on Speak. And there was a cash prize for that. And also the chance to perform on Speak in September. That date was picked for this. And so last year, a number of people applied. There was a committee. Diane was picked. It was not an easy choice. I might have been at the end, but I know the top three people that I was on a committee, and the top three I picked, I would have had a guilty time being the one saying, okay, this is the one. Because then I would have said, well, I don't know, wait a minute. You know, but this is going to be a wonderful chance for Diane to debut this story, and she'll be doing it twice. On Tuesday at the hall, I forget the name of every week.
Reynolds Hall.
And then on Wednesday, she'll be doing that in the
community club.
Oh, boy. And one is, you won't be so shocked, because you've known me for a while now. But one of these days when I'm going to say, excuse me, I know we're on a radio together, but would you introduce yourself to me so I don't forget who you are again?
I need that all the time. I was at a gathering Friday night, and I had to stop myself in the middle of a sentence and remember who I was talking to.
Oh, boy.
Yep. Well, tell us, to give us the website for Speak so people can.
SpeakStoryseries.com. And you can look on there and find exactly all the details about the time, about tickets, about possible donations. If you're interested in storytelling and promoting Speak, this is our 11th year. And Adam Booth has done a wonderful job creating this series and continuing to bring it. And I'm really excited about it. After Diane, the next 2 months are going to be Lynn Ford, Halloween, and I think I have the feeling, maybe I'm guessing, but I believe she's going to be doing some stories maybe for Halloween.
Yeah, she tells some
great Appalachian
tales. She is famous for her scary stories.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that too.
In November, Bill Harley. And Bill Harley is very popular with everyone. Two-time Grammy Award winner, and he does incredible stories, always has his guitar, gives us some songs and things, and I'm looking forward to seeing him again.
That is quite a lineup.
Yes,
it is.
Yes, and then we'll be off in December, and I could suggest to people that if they're interested also in making sure that they get as much good storytelling as they can, they could look into the Pittsburgh storytelling situation with TELL, capital T-E-L-L, at Pittsburgh Storytelling. And they have sort of copied Speak. Actually, they have copied Speak. September, October, and November, there will be individual great storytellers performing, and then in December there was going to be an olio of stories presented. in a similar fashion to what Speak has been doing. So also there's lots of places on the web everybody can find. All you have to do is put in storytelling, and you better have a good cup of coffee with you and plans not to go to work if you want to just read everybody who's performing.
All right. Well, let me put in a quick word for Stories in the Round. Next Monday at 7 p.m., the Antietam Story Guild, led by Mark Brew, will be showcasing 5 liars or tall tale tellers, and Stasz Zielkowski is one of them. There'll be a competition, so come on out and root on these storytellers for the grand prize. If you want more information, you can call me at 301-730-1638, 301-730-1638, or go to fanitsky@hotmail.com.
Oh, Rat, I was hoping you'd continue the musical introduction and do something funny with Fanitsky.
F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y.
There you go. Okay. I have a question, and I'm just, this is something curiosity that popped in my head. Other than you, who has performed the most at Stories in the Round?
I have no idea. I never thought about that.
You don't keep a list, I guess.
I do, but I don't have it in my head.
Oh, okay. All right.
But, and it's not in front of me.
I was just curious.
I'm curious, too. I will try to look that up. Andy's been 3 or 4 times. Susan Gordon's probably been at least 3 times. Maybe 4. Susan's performed 5 times?
No, I wasn't doing that for Susan.
For who? Oh, you and me together?
No. Well, you and me together and me by myself.
Okay. 6 times.
There'll be 6 times. Monday will be my sixth time.
Probably you.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. I don't think there's anybody else who's performed there.
Yeah, because we've done 3 shows together, and then we did one in November last year, and then the first time you hired me was the other century, I think.
Yeah.
Or the other decade. I believe it was 2015.
That could be.
Yeah, and then coming up. So I'm looking forward to the Liars Contest because, you know, I've set a challenge for myself. So my words have to really tell the story.
There is so much exciting storytelling going on. I am really excited about Diane Macklin tomorrow evening. I hope to get to both of her shows. Boy, oh boy. And then Lynn Ford. And then Bill Harley. And all the stuff we have going on at Stories in the Round. So
yeah, I won't be there tomorrow because I haven't been released yet.
I know, but you'll be on Zoom. I know you will be.
I will be on Zoom, yes.
Do you want to tell?
Well, I think, yes.
Okay.
I think you may have to stop me. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Now, there's a daunting task.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to put Terry on my speed dial so she can come water on you. Oh,
well, she's not here right now. She had to go pick up some groceries or
trouble. Will she be home in the next half an hour?
Oh, probably.
All right.
Okay. So here we go.
Have to call for reinforcements.
Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. Started out as a wonderful morning in chemistry. This was during my teaching career, near the end of my public school career. But what was interesting was that 90-minute classes is what was going on at that time and still is in many high schools, even in some middle schools, I've been told. So I was in my first period class. They probably had been about maybe an hour into the class, and the teacher from next door, actually I was in a chemistry lab, which had a doorway leading to another class, that, and there was no door on that doorway. It was really weird. And then there was a little hallway that led past my lab preparation room to a biology room. All of a sudden, the biology teacher came out of his room, stepped into that hall, and shouted actually at me. You know, it's just the width of the or the length of the classroom. Turn on your TV. And I said, "What? I'm in the middle of a lesson." No, you turn on your TV. You should do it right away. So I had a TV in that room that I never watched, and I only used it if I was going to be out of school and left a lesson that involved one of my videos that I would make. But I went, pushed the button, turned on TV. It was hung up in the air. All of a sudden, my classroom, where the kids were making a bit of a hubbub while he was shouting about the TV, wanting to know what's going on, it got deathly quiet. Looking at the TV, and I don't remember the exact time. I probably should have. I'm sure there are people all over the country who remember exactly what was their first impression and what time it happened. But there was a picture of a smoking tall building. And some of the kids were saying, "That's New York. That's, you know, that's the World Trade Center," all this stuff. And I said, "Would you please let everybody try to be quiet so that we can hear what's being said?" And that was the beginning of one of the longest days in the classroom. I had about 28, maybe 30 kids in that class. And over a period of, the next hour or so, I wound up with almost 90 kids in my classroom, my lab. A lot of them just sitting on the tables. And of course, all the chairs were filled, some sitting along the side of walls. Because the classroom next door did not have a TV, and the biology room was packed with kids. And so with that group of kids, who I must say were extremely, extremely well behaved, we stayed like that. There were no exchanges at the end of classes. The announcement was made that students should stay where they are and under the care of the teachers, and there will be no regular schedule today. That was confusing because there were messages back and forth that didn't seem to make a lot of sense. Some kids worried about, will we have lunch? Are we going to get out of school early? What's going on? And then in watching the TV, and there really wasn't a lot of noise, and the questions from kids about, are we going to have lunch today? Are we going to get out early? What's going on? We began to hear the details, and we got to see the second plane hit a building. And then we started to learn about what was going on, except there were the details were so shaky. We really didn't learn about what was going on. We just knew that one of the towers had been hit by a plane, and now a second one. And the smoke was pouring out of it. There were sirens, loud fire engines, ambulances, people, just a horrible kind of scary thing. And to their credit, I was teaching at Frederick High School, and to their credit, the students behaved as well as they possibly could. I think they behaved probably better than if there had been anywhere between 30 and 90 adults in the room. One of my students who paid close attention to the TV and was taking notes, realized that one of those planes had come from somewhere in the Northeast, and Boston, I believe it was Boston Airport. And she came up to me and said, "Can I use your phone in the lab prep room?" I said, "Yes, sure. What's up?" She said, "My mother was supposed to be flying out of Boston this morning, and I want to check with my grandmother. I'm staying at my grandmother while my mother was on a business trip." And that, unfortunately, fortunately, her mother was not on that one of those planes, but she couldn't get in touch with her mother. It turned out to be cell phone service was just going crazy. Hardly a lot of people had no service, all kind of mix-ups. And she was not able to get any information about her mother. It turned out that she and her grandmother did not know her mother was safe for another 25, 30 hours after that day, which had to be terrifying, because she did not know if her mother's plane was changed, if it was grounded or whatever. One of the kids that I often had issues with in my chemistry class a year before was repeating chemistry, and he sometimes could be a handful, but he was a big help that day. He had joined the football team as a senior and was playing, and it turned out that being on the football team apparently made a big difference in his attitude towards school, because he was doing well in my chemistry class, and he even helped with organizing some things with some of the kids in the class about sharing the lab tables and making sure that nobody was fooling with the chemicals and stuff like that. Another one of my students, who is very quiet, he was writing it seemed like he was writing for hours, and I'm probably exaggerating, but he was writing, he was taking notes, and it turned out that he was recording with his pen and notebook what he was hearing in the class. And at near the end of the day, I asked him about what he had been writing, and he said if I would care to, he would give me my notebook and I could read it that day. And I returned that notebook to him actually the next afternoon, and I wish now that I had asked his permission to copy it, because what a picture it gave of students quietly discussing what they were seeing, what was happening, what they were afraid of, wondering if we were going to be at war, if we were attacked by a foreign government. At the end of that day and the next day, I was pleased that a number of students came to me and said they thought that I had set a really nice tone in that classroom for people not to get too excited and to jump to conclusions and everything, and to give kids a chance to speak or question if they had a question, and that it wasn't, you know, like a general nonsense thing. It wasn't people yelling, and we had a civilized discussion, watching one of the most uncivilized things I'd ever seen on television. And as they went on, the destruction was horrible. It turned out that the student who had been taking notes and things also wrote a wonderful poem that, again, I wish I had asked him for permission to copy that, about what he was witnessing in the class, on the TV, and what he was hearing besides the notes he was taking. His poem was well written. I suggested to him that he should offer it to his English teacher or to the whoever was in charge of the yearbook, because I thought it was so well done. And it wasn't actually about the TV. It was about what he was witnessing among his fellow students. And he had touched on many levels. So anyway, that was a really hard day. At the end of the day, when they finally did dismiss school, I had no idea what was going on anyplace else. As far as, you know, my wife was teaching at Liberty Elementary School. And there were so many things unanswered. There was no one seemed to know what was going on. All air flights in the country were grounded. And the only plane, I found this out much later, the only airplane that was in the air after a certain amount of time, when the FAA, the United States government, whoever was making the calls and actually caused it, that, but all air traffic was grounded. And there is a book that was written not too long ago, and titled "The Only Plane in the Sky," and it was a wonderful book that gave some details. This is years after the event, about how, in the event of some horrible thing of our country being attacked, the president would be moved to a secure location in case DC would be attacked, and if that's where he was. And that book, The Last Plane in the Air, gets a lot of information for anyone who's interested in how the government actually behaved that day as far as communication. It was a day of horrible tragedy and incredible bravery on the part of some people. As I'm sure most people know, the number Flight 93, which was one of the planes overtaken by the crazy people who were bound on trying to destroy as much as they could. That plane was taken over by American citizens, who finally one man stood up and said, "We don't have to take this," or something. And they attacked the men. And there was a guy flying the plane who actually, they took over the plane, and the plane crashed in a field in Pennsylvania, and that place is now a memorial There is one more been constructed there, and people visit that. The news was horrible to watch, especially because there were so many people who died in that building. 3,000, and I think that's just a round number. And there's probably a specific number, but 3,000 people died in the towers that day, and the towers came down. The attack on New York, in that sense, was successful. The people who were behind the attack destroyed the World Trade Center buildings and caused terrible devastation to the other properties in that immediate area. And the loss of life was incredible. Unfortunately, there were people who took advantage of the situation, which I will say about more about after I stop talking now and give Fanny a chance.
Thank you, Sash. Looking forward to the other half of your presentation. I knew this would be an emotional radio program. You're listening, listeners, to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasz Ilkowski.
Today is Monday, September 11th, 2023. Our theme today is remembering 9/11. And Stasz has just shared his experience in a classroom, school classroom, during the attack on the World Trade Center. I'm gonna change gears. This is a very different presentation. I struggled with what to talk about and whether to share my personal experience that day or things that have happened since then. And this is what I finally came up with. So I'm starting with a short original poem. The lamp. And fear. Kindle your lamp, the light of your deepest hopes, to counter the darkness of pain and anguish, your own and that of others. Raise the lamp of reason, the flame of hope. Hold it high that others may see and believe in better times ahead. Love will prevail. And then I'm going to read from a piece that's based on an adaptation of a presentation by Reverend Eric Walker Wickstrom, which was delivered in Charlottesville, Virginia on Sunday, September 16th, 2001, the first Sunday after 9/11. There are people, many of them, though perhaps not the majority of people of my acquaintance, who base their lives on two basic tenets or theological assumptions. First, that the universe is inherently neutral on the subject of human survival, or even neutral on the capacity of humanity to survive, let alone thrive much longer into the future. I've never heard a convincing argument that we are destined or guaranteed of that survival, but I do hope it's true. Second, that every human being is due a fair chance at life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. While there certainly are humans who may lose that chance, still most people of my acquaintance believe that everyone born into this life deserves that opportunity. And yet every day we hear stories of pain and suffering, of wasted lives, of the apparent existence of evil, negative, punitive, vicious realities that permeate much of human existence. A simple list of the evils that any one of us hears of or encounters on a given day might soon fill a small notebook and fill our hearts with fear, outrage, and despair if we allow ourselves to dwell on these miseries. The simple recollection of today's date, 9/11, could send me into a tailspin of frightening memories and bleak predictions of the future. The attacks, the murders of innocent people, the apparent merciless enmity of those who carried out the attacks, and then the aftermath, misinformation campaigns that led to more killing and chaos elsewhere, released against other innocents in response to the tragedy here. There was much over the next year that could lead an interested and compassionate citizen with a modicum of political savvy to despair, to hatred of those who we witnessed participating in those brutal murders on this day in 2001, as well as the events that followed. The years since then have not been much better. COVID-19 causing different but comparable horrors and despair, grappling as we are still with unusual numbers dead from unexpected tragedies and misinformation campaigns, political opportunism, the breaking apart of national ideals and ever-widening political divides, ideological bunkers, silos. There is an apparent increasing tendency to see deliberate malfeasance, some might even call it manifestation of evil, in the behavior of people who seem radically alienated from the basic civic assumptions of our shared communities, willing to tear down institutions long trusted to protect the common good. In spite of the overall reduction in the formerly common belief in hell, we now hear more frequently the adjective evil applied to people and beliefs. And the use of that word, evil, sets up a category of other, separating those to whom the word is applied as something less than or apart from our own ascribed common humanity. Perhaps the use of this word evil is only a lack of imagination, a loss of language, an inability to find concepts to apply to or describe the terrible piling on recently of outrageous and terrifying events, each one seeming worse than the one before. This is pure and simple demonization. The describing of an entire group of people, whether they be people living on the other side of the world, subscribers to a different religion than ours, or a different set of political allegiances, a different preference for a system of governance, or subscribing to a parochial allegiance to clan or ethnicity, whatever indicators we use to identify difference or alien in order to claim that they deserve whatever calamity is about to rain down on them. Clearly, demonization is not an acceptable method for ascribing attributes to whole groups of people based on visible indicators, headgear, body parts, covered or uncovered, choices of particularly bad language descriptors meant to insult or antagonize. But even if we are specific in our demonization, targeting only the particular people who are in fact responsible for inventing or spreading information to control and inflame others, we are still probably making a mistake. If they are evil and we are not, that dichotomy created the beginnings of the same error which precedes every tragedy. The problem of evil is not its existence. That's a simple fact of life, a counterforce of nature. To imagine an evil that is separate from us, belonging to some other, them and not us is to divide the world rather than see commonalities and understanding, and therefore to create a different sort of evil. Human beings in all our diversity and plethora of beliefs and prejudices are one species, one family, children of the same spirit, or God, or universe. We share one universal reality that is this earth. Or in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., an inescapable network of mutuality. Those who worship a supreme being call human beings the family of God. Regardless of the label, we teach our children that it is our human connections that create our universal reality. We can trust in our reality as our shared faith. Another way to define evil would be whatever distracts us from our shared and connected reality. Whatever destroys our kinship or tells you that I am other, that is the root of evil. This dichotomy of good and evil can be a trap and a slippery slope to frame reality as two opposite forces separate from each other. Psychologist Carl Jung said, "The individual who wishes to have an answer to the problem of evil has need, first and foremost, of self-knowledge, the utmost possible knowledge of his own wholeness. He must know how much good he can do and what crimes he is capable of, and must beware of regarding the one as real and the other as illusion. Both are elements within his nature, and both are bound to come to light in him should he wish, as he ought, to live life without deception or self-delusion." Unquote. The religious response to evil, not setting it apart or intensifying the illusion of separation, but recognizing, as Carl Jung did, both how much good we ourselves can do and what crimes we ourselves are capable of, recognizing that both are found in me. Jesus said, "Let the one without sin cast the first stone." They do horrible, horrendous things. We want retribution. We want revenge. We want someone to pay, which is just what they said before the stones were hurled, the bombs dropped, or planes hijacked. This is just what evil wants. So we must take the harder route, opening our hearts rather than closing them, with compassion also for those who caused the suffering. This is difficult and necessary. Unless we respond to violence with peace, to hatred with love, to fear with faith, the cycle continues. Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, said, "An eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind." In the days, weeks, months, and years ahead, our resolve will continue to be tested. Recent incidents of violence will not be the last blows to strike us. We will be tempted again and again to enter a battle we can't win. It is the battle itself that is evil. We have a choice. We can say no to death and yes to life over and over and over again, no matter how hard it feels, insisting on the essential goodness of humanity, even in the light of horrendously evil acts. We can refuse to settle for the simplistic solutions, eye for an eye, even when it's our own eye that has been shattered. Even suffering indescribable anguish, we can refuse to replace the love in our hearts with hate. Faced with evil, the only response we can make is to continue to live, continue to love, and let this be what our children hear. Let this be what we say to our neighbors and to the world. And then I have a very short story from Parabola magazine, the issue entitled War, from winter 2002, immediately after 9/11. As a preschooler, my son Peter came up to me to bid me farewell. Off to battle, Mom. I've got my helmet and I've got my shield and I've got my sword and my dagger and I've got my gun. So I'm off to war, Mom. I said, couldn't you ask your enemy to come over and I'll make cookies for everybody and you could all learn to be friends? He looked at me like I just don't get it and said, but I want to use my helmet and my shield and my sword and my dagger and my gun. Then one late September, Peter, then in kindergarten, was in the backyard with Margaret from his class. Margaret declared they should build a home in the backyard. She instructed Peter to go get the swimming pool, and he dutifully dragged the small blue plastic wading pool under the apple tree. Margaret began to fill it with leaves. They both climbed into the pool, covered their legs with leaves, and Margaret announced the house was done. They sat together for a few minutes of domestic bliss, and then Peter fidgeted, looking bored, and announced, well, I have to go to war now. He picked up a stick and began walking off, brushing the leaves from his legs. When Peter was 8, we took a family trip to Southeast Asia for me to do research. In Cambodia, we saw many landmine victims with missing legs, arms, or hands, most of them men who'd been working in the fields and had triggered the mines. The kids were curious about this, so we told them that landmines are like little bombs that blow up when you move them, and that they had been planted all over this country in times of war. A week later, as we were touring the Angkor Wat temple complex, walking down a stone walkway, and there on the stone floor leaning against the wall was a pretty teenaged girl with no legs and small stubs for arms. Her eyes looked up at us and then at her plastic bowl. Someone must put her there in the morning and pick her up at night. I put some money in her bowl and smiled at her. When I caught up to Peter, who had kept walking, I could see he was shaken. His eyes were wild with questions, his brows furrowed. I walked beside him and put my arm around his shoulder. He said, don't people know what war does? Don't people know? That was a letter to the editor in Parabola magazine from a woman in Boulder, Colorado.
Wow.
I'll be quiet now.
Wow. That's good. And the first thing you talked about was from a news article, or was it a speech?
The first thing was a poem.
And then it was a speech.
And then it was a speech by our presentation by Reverend Eric Walker Wickstrom.
Yeah. Okay. I just wondered.
Yeah.
I guess I missed the name in the and my thought was only a man of the cloth or a woman of the cloth could say those words.
Yes, I understand that.
You know, and boy, I guess I think you've heard me say enough things that you know my feeling about the human race is much different.
There would be controversy.
Well, I don't want to be controversial, but I can't think of any place that I could pick up a newspaper article about and not read about the horrors of what one group of humans is doing to another. I mean, all over the world, and it's getting worse and worse and worse every day. You know, so many people, when I was younger, so many people talked about the Holocaust and all the terrible things that were done to the Jews during the Second World War, and it hasn't ended. It's, in fact, in our country now, it's getting even worse with the way that the Jewish people are treated. Synagogues are being attacked and I am probably not anyone that should talk about the future of the human race, because I don't think the human race has a good future.
there's nothing in what I read that will counter that.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
you know, there's, you know, the thing is that, you know, we, I think we have just gotten worse and worse and worse and worse, you know. Just this morning, I read a detailed description of why, after the Civil War, even though slaves were freed, why they should have been happy to be. They were better off. They were second-class citizens, but they weren't slaves anymore. And all I could think of was, I bet I can tell what color the skin of this person who wrote this. I guarantee it wasn't black or dark brown or, you know. I have never been able to understand how people can justify a horrible act having a good ending. No war has ever fixed any problem. You know, with the millions of people killed in the 1900s, just from 1900 to 2000, the number of people killed because of war is just incredibly large. You know, 50 million and possibly even more. And I don't know any good that has come out of Afghanistan, out of Iraq, out of certainly out of Korea, out of Vietnam, and the Second World War. We didn't fix anything with the war. And no war has ever fixed anything. Some wars have made the people who won better off and able to control the people who lost, but it hasn't made us a better race or fix the problems that were there. And I'm not a very positive person as far as human race goes. And I just think that in my lifetime, my 82 years, each year we have gotten worse and worse on this planet. There are more and more people being treated in a terrible way. And in our country now, our country treats people in pretty horrible ways, lots. And you mentioned some of that because of the politics and things. I mean, we have people out and out lying, running for office. People just incredible, telling incredible tales that aren't true. And yet thousands, millions are on their side. And the idea of the other is still so prevalent in this country and in every country I can think of around the world. I know there are a lot of people who thought, well, when people travel back and mix and everything, it'll be better. But I don't think the world is a better place just because people can mix. I just think some of the bad people go to where some of the good people live and vice versa.
I remember you saying you had a piece that you wanted to share at the end, and I don't want to lose that because we're almost out of time. Did you have something else you wanted something prepared? I mean, what you're saying, it's all part of the conversation.
Right,
about,
yeah.
That we go to a dark place. There's no doubt about it. That's where I go to. And I think you might have had some other
piece to share. I did, but the idea of saying this is gone. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I think I'm done. I just have such a negative idea about where we're going, and so much lying and so much treachery. And, you know, lately I've been writing responses to people asking for money. No one has asked me to vote. They asked me to vote for this and I'd like to vote for that. And then when you get down to the bottom of the thing, it says, and how much money will you give? And you can't submit the fact that you'll vote for that unless you give them money. And so I have started on everyone who sends me anything like that saying, if you stop asking for money, I'll read what you wrote. Because there, when I was younger, there were not 50 people knocking on your door and saying, would you give me $10 for my campaign and stuff like that? You know, it has changed so much that every politician has their hand out. And, you know, if they think they can buy a position because of money donated, that's the wrong way to get the position. You know, I don't want to elect somebody who's got the most money.
I think that to close out the show, we would probably allow John Case to have the last word on a positive note, because he just showed, his face just showed up. So I know he's listening to us and not just
right.
Playing with his machinery.
Playing machinery.
Recording machinery, yeah.
Right. No, I was thinking that you mentioned negative feelings, and I feel the same way that, you know, there's a tremendous crisis developing on a number of fronts. Things seem to be going off the rails, and you know, it's hard to see an outcome that's not pretty cataclysmic, you know, by whatever we used to call moons. Sort of, I don't know,
yeah.
but you know, so I consider myself an apocaloptimist. I mentioned this before, where yes, the apocalypse is coming, but you know, we'll come out of it the other side. We'll be okay.
Wow. That's great, John.
I mean, it's just like, we've been through, I mean, Rome fell. I mean,
and we're going to follow it.
just John and the cockroaches. We can.
You know, I just, you know, oh, man. So. Anyway, yeah.
By
the way, I thought the parable of the land of the blind, where, you know, the consequence of an eye for an eye. I thought that in that land, the one-eyed man was king.
Yeah. See, so many of those. So many.
That's
of
what
the
we used
stories
to say about Richard Nixon.
Yeah. Right. So many of the stories and, you know, stuff and everything, you know, I admire people who have a great positive attitude, and I have had a positive attitude at times in the past, but my positive attitude only works when I'm looking at a little child playing and safe and think, well, at least for this time, I don't have to worry about attending that child's funeral.
And that may be all the reassurance you get. I mean, I searched, I read a lot of stories. I read a lot of myths in preparation for this program.
Yeah.
The only way I could get to any sort of a hopeful message was to use pieces of that. That I did. So it's just staying in the moment and finding what sustains.
But, you know, even with 9/11, how many cases have there been of fraud, people claiming that their fiance or girlfriend or boyfriend or a relative was in the towers and collected money and stuff?
Oh, sure. Yeah,
and it wasn't true. I mean, there is no lack of evil in the human heart. Not in everybody's, of course. But it's incredible what people will do and take advantage of the situation. And, you know,
once you accept that, you know, you just have, I guess you just have to expect.
Oh, yeah.
That's who people are. You know,
that's like,
who we are. You know, that's how our brains work.
Cash is
Whoa. I don't think that's true. I don't think our brains work that way all the time. I think there are a lot of really good people. Unfortunately, I think the bad people outweigh the good. You know?
What my only message today, my main message is that all of us have the capacity to do stupid, negative things like that. And even the people who are stealing money from widows and orphans, there has to be some way to connect to them, or we are engaging in wholesale mass murder to get rid of anything that disturbs us.
So no. Okay. Well, that's what war does, right? Mass